Good morning. It's ski week, so we're all the ones left that aren't in Mammoth right now. So we can take a moment and feel sorry for ourselves, but everybody else, I think there's like 20 feet of snow on the top of Mammoth right now, so gosh, what a ski week. But not to distract you, I think you made the right choice being here this morning. I was thinking about that kind of as a question. Patty and I were talking about this idea of why do we come to church? For so many of us, something that is—it's a question that, well, I think it's an important question and one that can often change through time. But I imagine if we were to answer that, part of the reason would be community and connection. Part of it would be an opportunity to be encouraged and poured into. Maybe it's an opportunity to give back, worship from our hearts, or to experience God in a unique way. Maybe we come to be challenged, stretched, encouraged, pushed, corrected even. And I think all of these reasons for coming are significant reasons. That's not going to always be the same. It's probably dependent on which chapter you find yourself in life. I think sometimes we are experiencing God in ways that feel abundant, where He's near, and it's constantly bubbling out of us. And then at other times we go through life and it feels dry, where God feels hidden and we have to kind of chase after and find. I was talking about this with Patty, and Patty said, you know, I think right now the reason I go to church is just to keep my head in the game. And I thought, oh, that's a cool answer. I think one that's helpful as we've been thinking about Jesus and what He's been teaching us through this gospel. He's again and again talking about a kingdom, and how do we live our life in light of that kingdom? How do we set our minds on things above and not things below? And that if we're aware, if we can see this kingdom, be made aware of it, live our life into it, it's going to change the way we live. And when we lose sight of it, it's going to have a detrimental effect. We're going to find ourselves striving for things that are immediate, possessions and passions that have to do with this moment here, and we're going to lose sight of the deeper things, the things that ultimately are going to matter most. And one of the things, the sobering things that Jesus has taught us in kind of the recent sections that we've been going through, is that this life is not our possession, but instead something that's entrusted to us that we're a steward of. And it's not a gift per se, but something where there's an expectation of a return on the investment. Jesus described it as a mina, like a 3 months of wage that's been given to each one, and that God will come back and see what we've done with it. And those that are responsible, more will be given, and those less, it'll be taken away. And this idea of stewardship is one that we probably don't like to think about so often. It's this idea that we're accountable, that we're going to have to give a report on this. How have you done with what I've entrusted to you? And as Jesus has been teaching that, He's, you know, gone into the temple and basically rebuked it for completely failing in this project. He says the temple was supposed to be a house of prayer, and they've turned it into a den of robbers. That the religious leaders of that time had not just taken and hidden that treasure they were given, but they were robbing from God, stealing it, turning it into something that they saw as their possession. And that this is evident in the way that they live their life based on power and privilege, the popularity of the people. This has become what's driving them. And as they're offended by this, they begin to question Jesus in the area of authority. And this is really an underlying current through all these last few sections and today's section as well. The Pharisees just come out and ask Jesus that. By whose authority do you speak? Who gives you the right to say this? And what we see is Jesus with these questions responding with questions of His own. And what you see is Jesus trying to guide the conversation towards the real questions that often when Jesus answers, whether it's an answer or a question, He's always pushing them beyond where they are. I've heard it said that when Jesus teaches, He's always transcending their arguments or their questions. and also presenting something bigger, something that's more inclusive. So they say, Jesus, where do you get your authority? And he says, well, where did John the Baptist get his authority? And it points them right back into their dilemma because they're so afraid of what the people are going to say. And because the people value John, their authority becomes clear that it's not in God, it's in the masses and public approval. But Jesus has also pointed them to the truth that John declared over Jesus that he was the Lamb that had come to take care of their sins, and that in his baptism the Father speaks and says, this is my beloved Son. Well, the Pharisees don't hear that. They get kind of stumped, so they send spies in there, people that look like they're on board with what Jesus is teaching but are there to kind of trip him up. And they start pitting, you know, basically wanting Jesus to stumble by violating the Roman authority by standing up for his own. And so they say, Caesar demands this poll tax of all the Jews. Should we pay it? And it's this question that, again, is meant to get Jesus in trouble, because if he answers, you should pay this, well, he's telling them to pay this demeaning tax that is subordinating them to the Roman authority. And Jesus is the Messiah. He's the one who's come to overthrow Rome. So as the masses are around, they're saying, what are you going to say, Jesus? That they should pay it? What kind of Messiah would say that? And Jesus says, hey, take a coin out. And whose image is on there? Well, Caesar's. Well, give him his coins. And then give to God what is his. And he stumps them, right? By basically saying, hey, you see this as a battle between Rome's authority and Israel's authority, and I'm telling you, all of this is underneath God's authority. That this matter of this little tax in light of heaven is meaningless. That even Caesar, excuse me, bears this image of the divine and is accountable. And so if he's asking for this tax, sure. Why? Because these coins are going to be gone tomorrow. That in light of the kingdom of heaven, let's worry about what bears God's image and invest ourselves completely in that. And so they feel convicted once again. These are the people that have withheld what is God's and failed to give him what he's due. The Sadducees come up and they question Jesus about resurrection because they don't believe in it. And this is going to fit in, we're going to see, into authority as well. But as Jesus responds to them, they think they've found some little loophole in this thought experiment. And well, if you're going to marry all these different people, then who are you going to be married to in the afterlife? Therefore, no afterlife. And Jesus just goes, there's not going to be marriage there. And all of a sudden starts speaking to this second life. What is beyond? What extends beyond death? Once again, speaking into the kingdom of heaven and pointing them to truth that they couldn't just figure out on their own. It's revelation coming from eternity backwards to them. And the Sadducees, the ones that are asking him this question, are stumped by it, and they all of a sudden like leave with their tail between their legs, afraid to ask him any more questions. But I like how Jesus is going to keep going. And in our passage today, we see that not only is he unintimidated by their questions, but he's going, here's an even better question. It's like he's just getting started. It makes me think, I had a professor, J.P. Moreland, that I listened to debate this one time. And his opponent had asked him this question, and he was like, that's the question? Here, I'll give you a better question. And it kind of took and carried that guy's argument further and then kind of rebutted it and went on with his own position, which was clever. But Jesus, in a way, does the same sort of thing. Here are these people trying to trap him, question him, challenge him. And he navigates through this and keeps pointing them. It's bigger, it's bigger. And then all of a sudden, as these his opponents leave, he goes, here's... You want to really get stumped on authority? Think about this. And so in Luke 20, 41 through 44, it says, but he said to them, how can they say that Christ is David's son? For David himself says in the book of Psalms, the Lord said to my Lord, sit at my right hand until I make your enemies your footstool. David thus calls him Lord. So how is he his son? Okay, this is Jesus just going, here's an even trickier problem. Everybody's talking about the Messiah as a king from David's line. And prophetically in Psalm 110, here's this reference, this royal proclamation over David's descendants. But David will always have a king on the throne. And yet David, as he refers to it, refers to this Messiah as his Lord. And how does this work? That makes no sense. That the authority of that king in David's line should be getting his authority from David. And yet David seems to bow a knee. How could this be? And you see Jesus going, right? Haven't you all asked that question? And they're probably going, oh, no, sure, I don't know, no. Jesus is pointing to the depth and the complexity that's there, and I love how he's just unafraid of it. Instead, he's saying, lean into these questions because they unlock the deeper meaning. And he probably in this moment quoted the whole psalm. I don't know, but that's often would be the case, that he would reference a verse, but really he's referencing a passage. Interestingly enough, you get a clue in that. It's kind of like this Easter egg in Scripture, where when you go back into that Psalm 110 in verse 4, you see it makes mention of this guy Melchizedek, the top verse, 110 verse 4. The Lord has sworn and will not change his mind. You are a priest forever after the order of Melchizedek. So not only is this king greater than David, though he's from David's line, he's also a priest. And he's a priest forever in the order of Melchizedek. And you go, well, who's Melchizedek? And turns out he's this tiny little mention in Genesis all the way back. Abram, not even Abraham yet, the father of the nation of Israel, is being taken and led by God. And after a battle, he comes across this king, the king of Salem, Melchizedek. And Melchizedek comes out and brings Abraham bread and wine and serves it to him, which should be a little clue for us looking backwards. He basically comes out and serves Abraham communion. It says he was a priest of God Most High. Now God had just revealed himself to Abraham, but you realize that God has been speaking to more than just that. Here's another king. Who's a royal king, a righteous king. That's what his name means, is a righteous king. He blesses Abraham and says, blessed be Abraham by God Most High, creator of heaven and earth, and praise be to God Most High who delivered your enemies into your hand. And then Abraham gave him a tenth of everything. Isn't this interesting? This tiny little mention, and yet here we've got the bread and wine being served to them by a royal priest of God's, who precedes Aaron, where the whole priestly line stems from. That if you're a priest in the nation of Israel, you get it through this Levitical line, and yet here is a priest operating with an authority that precedes even Abraham, a king with an authority that precedes even David. And some have thought that maybe this right here is what is referred to as a Christophany. Has anybody heard this term? It's an appearance of the Messiah before Jesus. That maybe, just maybe, as God is saying, hey, I'm going to lead you to this new land and I'm going to show you who I am, that maybe he meets the Messiah himself. Certainly, if this isn't the Christ, it points us to it. And the author of Hebrews, in our next slide, is going to refer actually quite often to this man, Melchizedek. This king. And he says, first the name Melchizedek means king of righteousness, then also king of Salem means king of peace. Without father or mother, without genealogy, without beginning of days or end of life, resembling the Son of God, he remains a priest forever. So we know this, that the authority, the king authority, the priestly authority of Melchizedek precedes even his genealogy. It's coming there from the very beginning of time. And in this second section here, when we see the authority of Melchizedek, or the priest Jesus, proclaimed for all time, he says, and what we have said is even more clear, if another priest like Melchizedek appears, which is Jesus, one who has become a priest not on the basis of a regulation as to his ancestry, but on the basis of the power of an indestructible life. I love the way that's worded. And see, as the authority of Jesus' question, Jesus is going to go back. He's going to say, I have an authority greater than David's. I have a calling greater than Aaron's. And a role that is going to be proven that the strength of my credentials are found in the resurrection. That he's going to live a perfect life and an indestructible life that allows him and makes him worthy of both of these titles of king and priest. In a priestly way, he makes the way back for us from our sin to this place of being made righteous. And as a king, he's deserving of all we have. Abram, when he meets this king and is served this bread and wine, responds with a tithe, which is what you do to a king as a token. You say, my life is yours. And as an image or representation of that, they would give 10%. And Jesus is going to demonstrate this as like the fullness of their question, the fullness of authority. This is where it lies. And then he's going to respond now to his disciples with a warning to them. Because they too could so easily lose sight of this kingdom. And as they're stepping into their calling, how easy for them to make all of a sudden this world their chief end, the goals and the things of this world. And we know this is already the way they're thinking, right? They're still going to be competing to see who gets the seats of greatest importance on Jesus' right and left. So Jesus says this in the next verses of our passage. And in the hearing of all the people, he said to his disciples, beware the scribes who like to walk around in long robes and love greetings in the marketplaces and the best seats in the synagogues and the places of honor at feasts, who devour widows' houses and for a pretense make long prayers. They will receive the greater condemnation. This is the warning to go that not only is it possible for us to invest our lives in the wrong things, but when we take these things and we build our own kingdom, we find ourselves in a place of greater judgment. How responsible we are that we aren't taking these and promoting ourselves and building up this life into a place where we are savoring the pleasures at the expense of those that we could be investing them in. And see, I think most people, when they step into leadership, don't do it for the wrong reasons per se. But there's an appetite for it that, if we're not careful, begins to take over. It starts forming us, right? I've told you before about a friend of mine using the example. He's writing books and all of a sudden was speaking everywhere. And as a result of it, he was flying everywhere. And as a result of that, he started getting bumped up to first class every time he flew. And pretty soon, he just was a first class flyer. It starts becoming who you are. It starts shaping your expectations. And all of a sudden, the things that we have just seem normal and we start living our life for more and more and more. It becomes that temptation, that Turkish delight. It never quite satisfies us and we always find ourselves hungering. And if we're not careful, we start living for those praises. There's nothing like posting some image that gets a whole lot of likes and attention. And there's a rush that comes. Our brains love that kind of thing. And pretty soon, that's what we become drawn to. It starts shaping our hearts. And so he's saying, look, beware. Don't let this happen to you. I think it's the introduction to The Weight of Glory. Walter Hooper is a friend of C.S. Lewis. He mentions, like, hey, you know, your books are becoming kind of popular. You know, what do you do with this kind of fan base and these people that are starting to worship you a little bit? And Lewis says, you know, one cannot not think about that enough. And I love that, right? What you see is him saying, oh, it's a discipline. You know what you do? You don't entertain those thoughts. You don't savor the way that tastes. You don't live your life going after those things. Is success wrong? No, it's not wrong. In fact, if you're living a good life, people are probably going to come and ask you why. But when you start making that the end, when you start making that the pursuit, you start finding yourself in trouble. You start being shaped by that. I love this from Viktor Frankl. He says, don't aim at success. The more you aim at it and make it a target, the more you're going to miss it. For success, like happiness, cannot be pursued. It must ensue. To come as a result is the unintended side effect of one's personal dedication to a course greater than oneself. Once again, transcendence. Jesus is saying, seek first my kingdom. And all these things come with it. When you're at a party, go sit at the lowest table. If somebody pulls you up to the higher one, great. If they don't, great. Don't make that the end. Instead, keep your eyes set on a prize that's bigger and more true, and let that shape your life. These scribes were, one of their roles was taking care of the possessions of widows. They've lost their husband, and as a result of that, in that culture, have lost their provision entirely. And so they would entrust that to the church, and then the church would take a hefty cut. And as a result of it, keep these widows in poverty. And they're standing here in this courtyard where the women were able to come in and worship, and they've got these different receptacles out there where you could offer your tithe. And they were shaped like an instrument. And if you poured money into these receptacles, it would make this loud, beautiful noise, right? And so as Jesus is giving this warning, he looks up and saw the rich putting their gifts into the offering box, and he saw a poor widow put in two small copper coins, and he said, truly I tell you, this poor widow has put in more than all of them. For they all contributed out of their abundance, but she, out of her poverty, put in all she had to live on. This tiny little clink, clink off to the side. You know, you think about the recognition, the beauty, the impressiveness of this person's offering. And don't we like to, you know, be seen when we give? It's kind of like putting the money in, tipping at Starbucks, right? And if the person looks away as you put the tip in, you're like, it doesn't even count, right? Like, oh, shoot, you didn't see that? Like, now you didn't appreciate my generosity, right? And there's a Seinfeld where George Costanza is lamenting this, and he reaches back in because he's thinking, I'm going to pull it back out, and then I'm going to put it in again, and she just sees him steal from the tip jar. But this idea of recognition, right? It's like maybe where we draw the value. And here somebody is pouring all these coins into this, basically this trumpet-like receptacle. And everybody's going, oh my gosh, wow. How generous. And then this little widow goes over here and drops these in an embarrassing amount. Probably $2, something like that. And nobody notices. You know, I think I love this story for this reason, that nobody sees it but God, right? But He sees. He doesn't miss those things. In fact, He's like, oh my gosh, do you see what just happened there? And they're like, oh yeah, we totally saw. That was so beautiful. And He's going, oh, no, right? That, whatever, all that guy's coins, that was nothing like what she gave. And see, what you realize is like when we measure value, we count how many coins, like what dollar amount. And Jesus weighs. What Jesus does is He looks at the percentage. And not that it's about like outgiving to impress God or something like that. Not at all. But what she ends up putting in there represents so much more than some sort of monetary amount. And Jesus is saying to them, yeah, give, you know, give Caesar his tax. Who cares? But what He sees her give is her whole heart. That money is just simply a reflection of her deep faith and love and trust in God. She's practicing something in that gesture. It's an exercise of faith. And what you see is somebody, I mean, that's got this muscular strength in her faith. and courage and bravery. It's been said before that when we put money in the offering basket, we're thumbing our nose at the devil. We're saying, this doesn't have control. This doesn't have possession of me, which is so often what happens, doesn't it? That our money possesses us. And this is this way of practicing freedom. Of saying, my daily need, my daily provision is not based on my limited resources, but on God's abundance and love. This woman who may have been financially ruined by these scribes finds herself in the temple, putting this money back in. So we're going to go ahead and take offering again, if that's all right. Just kidding. We're not going to do that. Because it's not about the money, right? That's not the point. And what Jesus cares about here is the heart. That is, when he's talking about the kingdom is about the heart. And it's connected, all of this, heart and mind. There's like emotions and thoughts, and all of this is all a part of the same holistic soul. I like, there's a couple little definitions here, but yeah, skip ahead. We'll talk about that on Wednesday, so come on Wednesday. The ruined soul, this is Dallas Willard, the ruined soul is malformed and dysfunctional in mind, feelings, body, and social relations, largely due to hidden sin. The slide into the pervasive soul corruption begins with the heart or the will deflecting the mind from God and trusting in God. Do you see that? Like trusting in self allows us to hold on to our inner sin. It creates this kind of inward thing where our heart, which Willard is going to say, that's our chooser, our will. It's the thing when God talks about us bearing his image. It's the heart. So the next slide says, the will or the heart is the executive center of the self and our likeness to God being in his image. Will refers to that component's power to initiate and create, that thing in us that can create something from nothing. It's a bit of our like God-given power. Heart is not feelings, but refers to its being the center or core of the human being and the part to which every other component of the self owes its proper functioning. So the outward things matter, but only as a representation of the inward, which is why like Jesus in the Sermon on the Mount is going to say, look, if you've thought these things in your head and you held on to these things in your heart, the sin's already committed. The action is just sort of the outflow of that. This woman putting these two coins into the tithe of the church is an outflow of the heart, and the heart is what Jesus sees. A heart that basically says, I'm completely in your hands. You are my plan A, not my plan B. Which for me, just that alone is so convicting because I realize that God is so often my backup plan. That I go into life thinking, I'm going to give this my best shot, and if it doesn't work out, I'm going to pray. Whereas here she's just going, I'm all in. Right? My provision today is going to come from you. The little bit that I could buy with this, I trust you with, knowing that I can't outgive you. By man's standards, her offering is embarrassing, and by God's standards, it's profound. And what is she practicing there in this muscular faith that she's exercising is a heart that's free. This is when we think about salvation and the work that God is doing. It's a freedom. Part of it is a freedom from that self-serving, that self-promotion, that thing in us that's always turned back. Whether it's pride and arrogance or it's insecurity and self-pity, all of these things are just broken versions of a heart that's concerned about itself. And God's whole thing is to get our hearts free so that we can see and live our life based on pouring into others. That's what investing in his kingdom looks like. And as we come underneath God's authority, that's the life that we're being invited to. And it just so happens to be the life of joy, that life of generosity, this is where the good life is. Which is what's so exciting about our kids going on this trip, is they take their ski week and they invest this in the lives of these kids. The lives of building this home. I mean, I love that we got to see in that video. That's the home they're building. And those people that they're building it for don't even go to church, so they just get this taste of the gospel right there. But even more, you think if that seed of vision of living that sort of life can be planted in those kids, what can God do over the course of a lifetime? When we start living our life, making our decisions, making those investments in God's kingdom. And we may look back on our life with regret, thinking, oh gosh, I should have done so much more. And I think that there can be some conviction here, and that can be helpful and valuable. But really, in the end, I think no matter where you're at today, just begin investing. I was listening to a talk on neuroplasticity, which is just simply your brain's ability to change its mind. And what's fascinating to me about it is in these like new discoveries that you don't lose that ability. In other words, you really can teach old dogs new tricks. That you don't ever lose that ability to have your mind changed. I love how Paul is going to say, the renewing, right? The renewing of your mind. You live your life like a living sacrifice. Then you can test God's will. To offer our bodies as a sacrifice, this is our true worship. And as a result of that, we don't conform to the patterns of this world. We're transformed by the renewing of your mind. And this can happen at any point of our lives. The problem as we get older is our filter for what is important and what's not important. That's the thing that goes. But generally, that's a sort of laziness. And honestly, I feel like that lack of like proper attention, we're just getting worse and worse, younger and younger. That we live in this life that is filled with things that are saying, look at me, look at me, look at me. And isn't it interesting that the things of God's kingdom tend to come as whispers? You have to seek them to find them. And that is because that seeker, that's what God is there to save. He's saying it's there, but you got to listen for it. If I tell you, like, how many of you have been breathing this whole time as you've been listening? You're like, have I been? Well, you know you've been, right? But how many of you have been aware of that fact, right? We aren't aware. We just, it's rote, and it, as a result of it, fades until all of a sudden we're having maybe trouble breathing. But this idea of paying attention, now you're all watching yourself take breaths, right? Like, oh, I am breathing. And I think in some ways this is like giving attention to the things that matter as a sort of daily practice. It's the power of this woman walking in and going, there's my 2 cents, like, money has no control, God, you have my life. Doing that over and over and over again forms who you are. I think it was Annie Dillard that says how we spend our days is how we spend our lives. Which means the little decisions that we make along the way end up being hugely important. The little steps that we take to live in God's kingdom and to practice it. And Jesus is going to say, do those things, live generously, be devious about doing good things for people. Do them in such a way that nobody notices. Now you're practicing the kingdom of God. Be sneaky, be secretive, right? Don't take credit. Don't look for ways that are going to, you know, in the end come back around and make you look good. Find those ways to give where you're practicing selflessness at the same time. I love this verse in James. James says, religion that is pure and undefiled before God the Father is this: take care of orphans and widows in their affliction and keep oneself unstained from the world. Those two things, side by side. Help the people that are in need, that have no way of giving you back something in return. And keep yourself unstained from the world. And man, that last one, the unstained from the world, it is brilliant. There's this term salience. Salient information is like the, look at me, look at me, look at me, right? God's coming in as a whisper, and this is going like, this is flashy, or this tastes really good, right? This is the fast food candy over here. And to go, it takes an act of will, an act of choice. But when we're living our life in that kingdom and going, okay, what am I after then? It helps us to focus in and go, no, this is where I'm spending my time. That I could burn through a couple hours, you know, looking at my Instagram feed, or I could write somebody a letter telling them how much I appreciate them. That I could go buy a really nice $7 cup of coffee, or I could give it to somebody who needs a meal. That I can make these little choices along the way of intentional sacrifice. And God's saying, you know what will come to, you know, in the spirit of this Marie Kondo, whatever, like, choose joy, right? She's the one that's telling you to get rid of everything. Just hold on to what makes you joyful. But I think even to live into God's kingdom would say to give away what gives you joy. To invest that in somebody else. That's the good stuff. That's the thing that stirs our hearts. And you know what? Those are the things in life that you remember. The things that really cost you something. Because then you're giving away from what is most precious. But I think God is going, just try to outgive me. Here's some questions. And, you know, these might be, you know, take these with you and look at them each day as a way of like, you know, right now, all right, God, what are we working on? How do I keep my head in the game, right, as Patty said? How do I keep the main thing, the focus? Think through your daily life for a moment. Are there behaviors or possessions or affirmations that are keeping you preoccupied with this life and preventing you from investing in things that matter most? You know, I love how our devices now at least give us some sort of report of how we're spending our time, which you're like, how do I turn that off? But did I really spend that much time staring at this device? But you go, gosh, to notice those things, to realize how valuable and precious that time is. What are the things that, number two, the distractions keeping you from paying attention? Sort of the loud, noisy things, or the things that just taste good, you know, that you find yourself going to immediately. How can you redirect or renew your mind in moments of distraction? How can you take every thought captive? I think there's like little ways, just little hacks that you can do on your life. I remember reading a biography of a missionary where he vowed to every hour just recommit his will to God's throughout the day. Like almost like set a little alarm on your phone of going like, oh yeah, not my will, but yours be done. What are some ways that you can create these little disciplines to bring yourself back into that kingdom to keep you present? There's just a little, you know, a couple other things we're out of time, but that occurred to me. I love this prayer book by John Bailey. And in that prayer book, there's a prayer for every morning and every evening. And in that book of prayer, he starts every day going, God, this day is yours. Use me. And generally in the evenings, he finishes by saying, sorry, I'm going to do better tomorrow. And I think that that is sort of how we live, right? That we're not trying to earn some affection or prove some sort of value. We're trying to live into this calling that each of us was designed for. To invest our lives in glory. Last one, where should you be instead be investing? Where is God asking you to be more generous? What would it be like to truly trust in God's provision instead of using Him as your backup plan? How can we, gosh, maybe it's even just testing the water, little steps for us. But how do we be a people that are walking more and more in light of this widow and her mites that she invests? How do we give more and more and more of our hearts? I think as we do, God is going to say, we get faster, we get stronger. And not in the way that like we get recognition and power and glory. Well, maybe we do get glory, but in the heavenly sense. But with that, Jesus is going to say, comes abundant living. With that comes true joy. With it comes freedom from our petty, little, comfortable stories that we want to tell. In this invitation then to live our life for something transcendent and bigger in His authority, in His kingship. Let's stand. I'd just like to pray for us today. If you're on our prayer team, I'd encourage you to come down. And if you'd like prayer, we'd love to pray with you. But God, as we close, thank you for the challenge of this. God, that you stand as our King and our priest forever. And that you prove that by your indestructible life that you invite us into. And not just life, but abundant life. And God, I pray that the things that are holding us back and keeping us small or distracting our attention away from what really matters, God, that you would give us clarity of vision, ears that are sensitive to hear your voice. God, a heart that's stirred by living generously, that we would invest our lives, our hearts, everything we have in your kingdom, God, that we would be stewards of what you've given us and that you would be pleased, that we would be good and faithful servants with all you've given us, we pray. In Jesus' name, amen.